Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, September 22, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today we'll be talking to Josh Wright, former commissioner on the FTC. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. This is our first ever teleforum conference call with an in-person audience, so bear with us as we sort of work things out. This is supposed to go seamlessly, but we'll all find out along the way how it goes. I want to thank Covington and Burling for this very nice space, and of course I want to thank Deborah Garza for moderating and Josh Wright for participating in this first ever teleforum call with a live audience. I'm going to introduce our speaker in a moment, and then I'll get out of the way. But just to let you know how things are going to unfold, at about the 30-minute mark or so after an interview being conducted here, we're going to turn to the audience for questions that will include our telephone audience, and it will also include our in-person audience here. So if you're among the audience in the room and you have a question, we need you to use this microphone so that the people on the telephone can hear your question and then hear the response to it. But we welcome questions from both the in-person audience and the telephone audience. Deborah Garza is co-chair of Covington and Burling's Antitrust and Competition Law Practice Group. She has been involved in some of the largest antitrust matters in the last 30 years, including the ExxonMobil merger and the government suit against Microsoft, and much, much more. She joined Covington in 2009, coming from the Justice Department, where she was the head of its antitrust division. She has an otherwise long and distinguished career. I could take up a lot of our time covering it, but rather than that, let's get right to the program as I turn things over to Deb Garza.
Great, thank you. Welcome to the audience, to our guests, guinea pigs, guests, whatever. I hope that this goes well with the audience, and please feel free to come up to the mic at the appropriate time and ask questions. Josh Wright, I think, may be known to many of you, but I'll take a little bit of time to give you a little bit of his background. He was sworn in as a commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission in January of 2013, where he served until late last month, I believe. Prior to joining the commission, Josh was a professor at George Mason University School of Law, where he also held an appointment in the Department of Economics. And that's where he's gone back to now, teaching courses in economics and antitrust law. Josh is a leading scholar in antitrust law, economics, and consumer protection. He's written many, many articles, blog posts, which is how I was first introduced to Josh, book chapters, et cetera, et cetera. He has co-authored a leading casebook. He has served as co-editor of the Supreme Court Economic Review and as the senior editor of the Antitrust Law Journal. Josh had three prior terms at the Federal Trade Commission. He was its inaugural scholar in residence in 2007 and 2008 in both the Bureau of Competition and the Bureau of Economics. And then prior to that, he interned at both the Bureau of Economics and the Bureau of Competition in 1997 and 1998. He's a graduate of UCLA. He holds a PhD, law graduate of UCLA, and holds a PhD in economics from UCLA as well. And he has taught at Pepperdine University. I don't know if there's anything else that you want to tell about. So the bottom line is Josh has had a long and terrific career, even though he's quite young, in antitrust. We want to talk to Josh today a little bit about specifically his experience at the FTC. And Josh, I'm not going to start off with a softball. So I'm going to ask you about the FTC policy statement on Section 5 that was issued in August. And when you came in to the commission about 6 months in, one of the very first things you did was to issue your own prototype statement, about 15 pages long, give or take. We'll talk about some of the aspects of that. This statement is a little different from the one that you put out for consideration in June of 2013. But you did sign on to this statement. This statement, for people who aren't aware, is about a page long. I think it is in fact a page. Three quarters of a page. Very brief. So what I want to ask you about is essentially, that statement is very different from your statement. So I'd like you, if you could, to talk about the differences and to explain, you know, why you agreed to sign on to it. Did you change your mind? Is there some reason why you were willing to sign on to the statement, even though it seemed to lack significant aspects of the statement that you put out? And just to give the audience a little bit of a background, what I'm talking about in particular is one of the approaches that you suggested was that the commission issue guidance that would include examples of what would be covered and not by Section 5. You suggested that Section 5 should not be used for any conduct where there's a cognizable efficiency because of the difficulty of parsing whether or not something was anti-competitive. And the policy statement that was issued didn't go that way. You suggested that that Section 5 only be applied where there's substantial harm. The policy statement that was issued didn't talk about substantial harm or significant harm, just talked about harm. So I'd like to maybe if you could talk about some of those differences and other differences, and how do you reconcile?
Sure. So thanks for having me, and Dean, and it's a pleasure to be up here with Deb. So I like starting at Section 5. I'm very, very pleased with the statement that the Commission generated. And Section 5 has been something I've been thinking about and writing about for years and years, and I think that there are, I think the longer that the statement marinates and people sort of have time to reflect on what it means and what the Commission does under it, I think I really do believe the statement is going to be very successful in achieving many of the goals I had in mind with the proposed policy statement. It certainly does not go as far as my original statement did, which was sort of highly restrictive as to what the standalone unfair methods of competition space. But let me sort of back up a little bit and talk about why writing Section 5 guidance is so important to begin with, what I perceive to be the problem, and sort of how my statement versus the ultimate commission statement deal with the problem. There are really two issues to do with Section 5. One is that the nature of the unfair methods of competition authority is unbounded. It's never been defined until now. And so if you look at interpretations of the commission statement over time, if you look at the commission's interpretations of unfair methods of competition over time, they're whatever three commissioners want it to be at any point in time. And there are some great examples in there of interpretations of the unfair methods of competition authority that go well outside the bounds of traditional antitrust. Things from climate change to labor relations to, those are interpretations sitting commissioners had. Prominent academics, so John Baker, who was the director of the Bureau of Economics, and Steve Salop at Georgetown wrote a paper saying we ought to be using Section 5. Why aren't we using Section 5 to battle income inequality? These are things, whether you think that those are good policy ideas or not, these are things that are traditionally well outside the scope of the normal antitrust laws, and for which I think there is a consensus that sort of bringing those things into antitrust is probably a bad idea and probably happens at the expense of consumers. Now, so sort of point one, that authority is unbounded, and we've got lots of examples of using the unbounded nature of that authority to the advantage of the agency, but not necessarily to the advantage of consumers. So problem one is that it's unbounded and not been defined. Problem two is what happens to a Section 5 case when it is prosecuted through the agency. So through our Section 5 authority, the FTC has considerable administrative advantages. For example, there's a Section 5 case. We decide not to sue you in federal court under the traditional antitrust laws, where we have to prove things like harm to consumers and market power and all of the things that antitrust students learn that antitrust law is. We say, well, we've got Section 5, and by the way, you're violating it. Well, how do I know? Well, there's no definition. You know, because three commissioners will vote for the proposition that you violated it. You can see where this is a problem. Where do you go to resolve that dispute? Well, three commissioners vote. Where do you go? Maybe you litigate the case in front of an ALJ, and then it's reviewed by the commission. Well, the commission's historical record for the last 25 years is that in 100% of the cases where it reviews an ALJ's finding, it's ruled in favor of the commission. 100% is, well, that's a high number. You know, LeBron James shoots, I think, 87% from the free throw line with no defense. 100% is not picking good cases. It's a superpower. And generally, I think that is a bad idea to bestow a regulatory agency with superpowers. And so I think the unbounded nature combined with that gave rise to a significant problem. There are two ways to solve the problem. One way is to restrict the scope of Section 5. My proposed statement did exactly that. My proposed statement would have said, FTC, you can use your unfair methods of competition authority, but only in a narrowly circumscribed set of cases, in particular only cases where there's significant harm and no efficiencies. The reason for shrinking the scope of the unfair methods of competition authority is on a standalone basis. One, if you believe that the administrative problem is that every time the FTC is weighing the cost and benefits in a traditional rule of reason analysis, it rules for itself, my proposal would have taken that away, right? You can only do UMC Section 5 cases where there's no balancing. So it would have dealt with that directly. And it would have shrunk the scope. The cost of that probably be under my proposal. There are some cases you probably couldn't get to under Section 5, and you, FTC, would have to go to the Department of like the Department of Justice does, to federal court, and win your case under the traditional antitrust laws, which I don't think is that horrible of an outcome. That was my proposal. The current proposal takes a different tack. But I do think it takes, I mean, one of the reasons it's so different is that it tries to achieve the same end with a different strategy. Okay? It does not in some places go as far as I would like to go, but I think the shortness of the statement is a little bit overplayed. I wrote 15 pages because I had a lot to say. If I could have incorporated by reference someone who had said it before, I would have. I'm a law professor. I know how to use footnotes. You know, and what happened with the short version of the statement is that the commission said, we would like to incorporate by reference the rule of reason as understood under the traditional antitrust laws. They cite to Arita and Hovenkamp, the leading antitrust treaties in the world for understanding antitrust law, and they say, you know what we mean by the rule of reason? We mean what they mean. We mean the traditional rule of reason that I've got a couple law students in the room that they learn when we teach about the rule of reason, that the antitrust lawyers in this room learn when they learn the rule of reason. That happens in federal court when courts litigate disputes under substantive antitrust provisions that require rule of reason analysis. I think the statement is very clear about incorporating by reference. We mean that rule of reason. We mean the harms that count under that rule of reason. We mean the significance of the harms that count under that rule of reason. We mean efficiencies as contemplated under the rule of reason. I really don't think the statement could have been clearer about that. And I think, you know, incorporating by reference, and in fact we use that term, all of the traditional antitrust laws is and the rule of reason analysis there is a different methodological sort of way of solving the same problem. I will say the short statement does three things. One of the things it does is it says Section 5 will be interpreted in a manner that is consistent with having consumer welfare, like with the traditional antitrust laws, the exclusive goal of unfair methods of competition authority. That, I think, is relatively low-hanging fruit. I don't think that there's much dispute that that is the way that the commission should interpret it as unfair methods of competition authority. The leading critique of this provision is that it just doesn't do much. I think that that criticism that I've heard made, or one is in Commissioner Olhausen's dissent, but I've heard a couple of other sources make this criticism. I think that's just misses the history of Section 5. I gave you a couple of the examples of interpretations that have nothing to do with the antitrust laws. Those were not from 1890 and they weren't from 1910. Those were from the 70s and 80s, and the Baker and Salat paper, I think, just got published in 2015. Right, to use income inequality through Section 5. These are very real proposals. There are some others, very real proposals now and in the very recent history of the agency to use Section 5 for purposes that where I think there is broad consensus are antithetical in some places and certainly in conflict in others with the traditional antitrust laws. So I think that was I think it's an obvious step in the right direction. I think it's an important step in the right direction. The second is to do rule of reason, is to do balancing, is to do the traditional rule of reason. Now, the statement does say the rule of reason as applied under the other antitrust laws, right? And it sets forth a standard. To me, there are two ways to deal with, I said, sort of the scope in the administrative process. One thing is to heighten the burden. So Commissioner Olhausen had a proposed standard of her own where we would have said the harms disproportionately are greater than the benefits of the conduct. My proposal would have said wherever you apply the unfair methods, you know, we're not going to do any balancing at all because you can't use it where there's efficiencies. I don't think playing around with the burdens of proof does much, and I never did. And the reason I don't think it does is because it misses the administrative part of the problem. When the person judging the cost and benefits has ruled for themselves 100% of the time, you could say that harms have to be greater than benefits. You can say they have to be really, really bigger than benefits. You can say significant, disproportionate. You can use words you want to play around with those numbers. But the 100% figure should suggest to you that something in the balancing has gone awry. That is not what happens in balancing in federal court. So I never was very comfortable with the idea that we were going to solve that process problem by playing around with the burdens. I think the main advantage of the statement really is in the third prong. The third prong of the current statement gets something that even my proposed policy statement didn't, which is a commitment from the agency, an acknowledgement by the agency, that where the traditional antitrust laws apply, it is more appropriate to use those laws than to use the unfair methods of competition provision. It is certainly true. I would have really liked that third prong to say shall not instead of less likely. Absolutely. I would have liked that. The real power in guidelines, as most practicing antitrust lawyers know, it's not that the agencies write down something in the guidelines that says shall not or will not. It's the ability, if push comes to shove in a Section 5 case, to go to court and to say, this is the Federal Trade Commission doing something that its guidelines say are inappropriate. This is the way we use guidelines provisions in the merger guidelines. This is the way that the unfairness guidelines are used on the consumer protection side. And I think, historically, the agency saying that the relationship between the UMC authority and the rule of reason is sort of clearly spelled out, and it's spelled out in a way that suggests that the agency itself knows where there is clear antitrust doctrine governing some conduct that it ought to use the traditional antitrust laws. That, to me, is a major concession. I think the importance of that concession will grow over time as we get Section 5 cases to sort of run through the agency. But, you know, I'm an empirical guy. The proof will be in the pudding, but I think we'll see.
So a question that people have asked me, I'll ask you, which is what is the practical effect of the guidance, of the policy statement?
So a couple of things. One is antitrust lawyers who know how to counsel the rule of reason can counsel Section 5 cases. Antitrust lawyers who own a copy of Arita and Hovenkamp can counsel Section 5 cases. That wasn't true a month ago, and that is true today. Now, we'll see what the agency actually does with it. And it may be the case, and one of the things I've said is that the guidelines may well affect the agency's willingness to litigate. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. When you have a body of law, but there are no cases. When you have an enforcement authority where there are no cases, having a litigated case set out a rule is not such a bad thing. Having the agency litigate an invitation to collude case would not be the end of the world. We may get an Article III judge to settle what doctrine is in those areas. I would view that as beneficial. If you look at the evolution of traditional antitrust doctrine, what has happened to antitrust law substantively from the 60s and 70s to current, it has been, compared to any other body of law, to sort of sit down and watch the evolution of cases, there's been an absolute revolution and integrating economics into modern antitrust analysis, and I think much to the benefit of consumers, certainly over 1960s antitrust law and 1970s antitrust law. That revolution has skipped over Section 5 entirely. It's not been a part of that, and it's not been a part of that in part because those cases don't go to court, because the agency can settle them on whatever terms that it wants because of the authority it has to litigate those through the administrative process. I think this cures some of that. I think it gives parties the ability to say, I think I win this under the rule of reason. If you want to bring a bad case under the rule of reason and extract a settlement, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to litigate this, and we're going to ultimately go see an Article III judge and have them determine the scope of the authority. So I think it emboldens parties somewhat. On the other hand, I think it emboldens the agency somewhat. The agency says, I think I can win an invitation to collude case under a standard that's articulated in the statement under a rule of reason standard. So let's go to court. And I think, you know, some of that is going to clarify the boundaries under, for Section 5 law, as opposed to stacking up a pile of settlements, which I don't think have much informative value therein. I think we'll have a transition period where some of that happens and people feel out what the boundaries are. It's important. I think sometimes people say, well, you'll get more litigation, as if that's a criticism of the statement. Litigation will set the boundaries. More litigation can be bad, don't get me wrong. But having litigation to set boundaries in an area that hasn't had boundaries for 100 years, we sort of take a deep breath and understand the context, is not so bad. And I think probably in this area of law is needed. It would not be a bad thing for the D.C. Circuit or whomever hears Section 5 appeal to say, goodness, under your statement, this is what we think Section 5 means. That, I think, is another potential advantage of the statement that I think is a little bit underappreciated at the moment.
Well, I might have additional questions to ask you, but let me move on in the interest of time. So one thing that has marked your tenure as a commissioner has been the number of dissents that you have issued. I didn't do the stats, and so maybe you have, and how it compares to Commissioner Rosch and other commissioners. But you have written a number of significant dissents, and it makes me think about when I chaired the Antitrust Modernization Commission in the very first meeting we had, one of my commissioners said, I can't wait, I'm writing my dissent now. And so, of course, we didn't have anything yet, but I did find that there were, you know who I'm talking about, Andrew. And so there are, but in fact, there was a lot of consensus. There was a dissenting statement from this commissioner, but there was a lot of consensus, and I thought the value of the dissenting view was very important in helping us to arrive at good analysis and good recommendations. What do you see as the value of the dissenting commissioner having been in that role?
Sure. So this is a question I got from time to time and still get from time to time, which, you know, sometimes I read as a little bit of a, why do you do that so much, which is fine. Truth be told, I think I do have the numbers. I dissented in 1%. I voted no, not written dissents necessarily, but I voted no in 1% of the consumer protection cases. I voted no in less than 10% of the competition cases. Some days that's treated like a revolution, which I find fascinating, and it's probably half a statement about me and half a statement about the agency. But I think it says both things when, on the consumer protection side, voting yes 99% of the time implicates very negative feelings about being hostile to the agency. It is, only full consensus need apply. But in the competition stuff, the dissent rate's a little bigger. And it tended to be when I voted no, I wrote. In my view, first I should say, I never did write a dissent before the case, sort of Mad Lib dissenting. I never did do that, but sometimes I had to write them quickly in response. But I went into most cases not writing things because I intended for them to be dissents. I went into most cases writing whatever I wrote and hoping I was going to win 5-0. That mostly suggests that I failed in some significant percentage of the cases to persuade people, and that is something that, you know, I take seriously. I try to persuade people to think about the cases the way that I do, because I think, sort of in my view, I'm just, you know, trying to get the cases right, and I've got a story to tell about why I think it's the right way, and this is what the commission's built for. You get 5 commissioners with very different skill sets. We've got consumer protection people and litigators, and Commissioner Olhausen ran the policy and planning shop, and you've got a lot of different skill sets sort of in the same building. People are going to see cases differently. I really do view that give and take among the commissioners and between the commissioners and staff as truly a feature and not a bug of the FTC structure. If you are not into that give and take, there are other structures available. The DOJ has it, right? We can do it a different way. I think I come from an academic background. I'm very much into the idea of the marketplace for ideas and battling it out to make the product better. I chose my career path because I like that, and I tried to treat my time in commission in a manner consistent with that approach. But But I will say, for full disclosure, I really hope that all the dissents, you know, all my 4-1s, I wish were 5-0s the other way. You know, there were more 3-2s than I wanted. There were more 4-1s than I wanted. That said, in terms of the value of dissenting, I think if you sort of put the competition, use those in particular, but even with the consumer protection dissents, I think if you put the dissents together, my decision rule for writing dissent was never do I want to explain to the world why I voted yes or no in this case. I think that's important. Mm-hmm. It's important to do. But usually it was, I want to explain my vote in this case because that relates to a very important issue and how the agency is deciding cases. Maybe I think we're doing it wrong. Maybe I think we just got it wrong here. But I think there are important issues that need to be vetted. And the bar and consumers and Congress and the people in the agency should know what the agency is doing, what I'm doing, right? And so I view some of it's transparency. And some of it, I think, you know, antitrust law has come a long way from the 1960s, but I certainly don't pretend we've got all the answers pinned, and I certainly don't pretend that I know all of them. I think one of the functions is to highlight hard questions and to say, listen, this is a hard question. This is the way I'm thinking about it. World that is coming to the FTC for votes, this is how I think about the world. I don't think you'll hear sort of many people complaining that I didn't share my views, or they don't know how I think about issues, and I didn't want to be mysterious, either inside the agency or out, because I think there's a benefit in that. But I think the real benefit, in my view, was getting the agency itself to participate in the marketplace for ideas. There are a number of dissents where, even though I was not happy with the outcome, you take Family Dollar merger. We talked about, you know, safe harbors and unilateral effects cases. I read the guidelines as having one. I read Carl Shapiro's DOJ speeches as saying the guidelines have one. I thought that meant we do too. And I wrote that we should, and I wrote why we should. And I voted no in a bunch of markets where the case would have fallen outside of that safe harbor. The big advantage of that case, but I got to share my feelings. That's great. I like to talk. But it forced the majority to write a statement that said, we, the FTC, do not have a safe harbor and don't believe there's one in the guidelines. That is not the outcome I want, but practitioners in the world learned something that day about how the FTC reads its guidelines. That, I think, is important.
So going off of that, I was going to ask you next about the role of the FTC as a co-enforcer of the antitrust laws with DOJ. And your last statement raised a question that hadn't occurred to me, which is the agencies both use the same horizontal guidelines, but is there a significant difference other than the one you identified in which, in your view, in the way in which they apply those guidelines?
It's very hard to know without seeing the way the sausage is made in the other factory, right? I'm pretty familiar with what we do. I mean, all of this is coming up in the context of cases that are investigated and then closed, or there are consents and they're not litigated. So, you know, whether the DOJ, for example, has a safe harbor as contemplated in the guidelines and by their chief economist who, at the time they were written, goodness, I don't know. I know the public statement says they have one. I know that the chief economist of the agency speaking for the agency said they have one. Whether they're actually doing that in practice, sort of law, you know, law on the street as opposed to law in the books, I don't know. I suspect not. But those ought to be things that are communicated to the bar. They felt it was important enough to put it in the guidelines. They felt it was important enough to give a speech to say, antitrust bar, remember sort of back to 2010 when the guidelines were getting published, there was a lot of heat about taking out a provision of the 92 guidelines that were read as a unilateral effect safe harbor by some, and the sort of general feeling that by de-emphasizing market definition and emphasizing competitive effects, an approach lots of economists are comfortable with, the guidelines maybe had taken away some of the off-ramps for cases that used to exist where you could tell parties you were counseling, this is within a zone in which I don't think there are going to be cases. some of those were starting to disappear, and there was a lot of heat. And I think one of the things that was done in response, I certainly can't speak for Carl Shapiro, and I'm not trying to, but I read part of the response by the agencies to say, no, this is a safe harbor. This is one. And I certainly read it as I taught it to my law students. I now teach them the FTC doesn't have a safe harbor. I tell them to read my dissent, and I stomp my foot a little bit. And they ask me, well, what about the DOJ? I said, well, nobody's rescinded the speech, but I don't know. DOJ rescinded the Section 2 report when they didn't agree with that, so they know how to rescind documents. They didn't rescind this. I presume it's still a safe harbor, but, I wouldn't bet my money on it.
All right. Dean, it's 12:30. Do we want to offer, are there any questions in the room? Would you like to come forward so we can, the purpose of coming to the mic is so that folks on the telephone can hear you.
Yeah, you need to come forward to ask a question. And while you're coming forward to ask a question, let's open the floor for our call-in audience to questions. So in a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. If you're a caller, after you hear that announcement, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone, and we'll take your questions. We'll go back and forth between the in-person audience here and the telephone audience. But please come on forward. So again, if you're in our call-in audience, you have a question, push the star button and the pound button. Let's take a question now from the floor. Go ahead.
My name is Antoinette Jefferson. I just wanted to know, you using the term rule of reason. Is that the term you were using? I didn't know the issue with the common, was it the rule of reason that the judge made or?
Common law, yeah.
The common law. And if it's legislative or constitutional, what's the issue? Is it about drafting?
So in the traditional antitrust law, so there's the Sherman Act is legislative, and the courts have interpreted the Sherman Act provisions to say the rule of reason governs when business conduct violates the antitrust laws. So it is judge-made law interpreting a statute. It takes the form of common law because the prohibition in the statute basically just said, don't do unreasonable things, and courts interpreted that for a long history over the Sherman Act to sort of insert this rule of reason. With the unfair methods of competition statute that we're talking about, the Section 5 statute, there was no such judge-made law and nothing from the agency to give that authority meaning. And so the agency guidelines are sort of for the first time saying, let's also do the rule of reason, which is where law in the federal courts has landed after 125 years. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yes, the rule of reason, the safe harbor, is that the leeway or the gap there that would allow them to either take it to the courts or would allow them to just go by precedent?
They can, under the rule of reason, for any conduct, if the parties don't think, the rule of reason just says if the harm to competition is greater than the benefits from the conduct, the conduct violates the law. So this is if the parties believe that their conduct doesn't violate that standard, they're free under the traditional antitrust laws to go to court and litigate that. The problem under Section 5 was it was very difficult to know the standard and to know when you were violating it. So this now is an attempt to equate the two.
I think that's all the questions that I had.
Okay.
Just one more thing. Are you a congressman?
No, I'm a commissioner. I was
okay.
A commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission. Now I am I'm just a guy.
Wrote a paper, 15 pages.
Yeah, and I'm a professor at George Mason.
Okay,
but so maybe you have a political future. You never know.
Not in Congress.
Okay, we have one question on the phone.
We do have a question on the phone. We'll get to that in just a second. If you're on the phone and you would like to ask a question, again, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first question from the phone now.
Matt
Will? Okay. Did you have a question, Bill? Please come right up to the microphone.
Thank you. I'm Bill Lichterman here at Covington.
Hey, Bill.
Good to have you here with us. Question for you about the Section 5 authority vis-a-vis the so-called trolls. and there was the MPHJ action, which FTC took while you were there. There's been both questions about how much latitude the FTC has to address these litigious kind of actors in this patent space, and also then congressional efforts vis-a-vis the Troll Act in the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House to actually clarify that authority. Just love to hear your reflection both on existing authority and whether or not legislation would be helpful.
Sure. So my own view, while I was inside and now, is that with respect to cease and desist letters and the like, right? With respect to trolls, I think the existing authority for MPHJ and cases along those lines, I've always been a believer that the existing Section 5 authority, the deception authority in particular, was sufficient. Some of the attempts in Congress to sort of clarify this authority, I think, can be moderately helpful around the margins, but I don't view the troll problem, to the extent that there's a problem with letters and the like, sort of false claims about having a patent or so forth. Things violate Section those examples, and the examples I've seen, violate Section 5 for sort of the real bad actors. What I worry about with any attempt to expand the authority is sort of sweeping in the authority to reach things that are much more complicated than deception or fraud with respect to owning a patent. And that stuff, I think, requires a little bit more thought. But my own view is that for the truly bad actors, the deception authority under Section 5 is more than sufficient as is.
We've got about 25 minutes left. If you're on the line and you have a question, our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We can also take more questions from our audience. Deb, I don't know if you have...
No, I have more questions.
Go right ahead.
I think you have one, a person here.
Baron Soka, Tech Freedom. So, Josh, two questions. One, what would you have done if you stayed on the commission longer? And two, what advice generally, not specific objectives, but in terms of how to think about the role and the commission and the future of the agency, what advice would you give to your successor?
Let me do them in reverse order. Goodness, I don't know. In terms of advice to my successor, I'll say a couple of things that I think I learned. One, it is absolutely imperative to surround yourself with staff who are the best people in the building. My staff were much better than me at everything that they did. I had a better economist than me on my staff. I had better antitrust lawyers than I am on my staff. And I had staff who would, if I was getting something wrong, would tell me, you are getting this wrong. Here are the reasons. And the door would stay open all day, and people would come and tell me I was wrong all day. And I loved that. That's no different than, sort of any other academic setting. And I think that we got right answers more often because of that. I think sometimes in the commission, I can't say anything about the way the other offices work. I have no idea. But I will say I think I benefited greatly from that setup. That I think enabled me to participate in more, a broader swath of issues. I think it allowed me to participate more intelligently. I think if you take your advising staff and you talk to them and you know them and you trust them, you set them forth into the world to go and give talks and write papers, I think you get to be in a lot more places at the same time. And you get to contribute more to the public good, which is what these agencies are for. So that's sort of number one. Number two, I would tell my successor, one of the things you ought to do with your four advisor spots is to have an economist. You just can't not do that at the Federal Trade Commission. There are 70 excellent PhD economists on the staff. That is not a reason not to have your own on your own staff. And so I did, and I had two of the best economists that I've ever worked with on my staff at different times, and I think I benefited from it greatly. And I think the big advantage there is on the consumer protection side. So on the consumer protection side, the consumer protection side of the House is, I think, experiencing growing pains a la antitrust in the 80s. People are just starting to think about complicated economic issues to do with privacy and the like. And there were growing pains in antitrust that sort of pushed back against integration of economics. You see those now in academic space. You feel them inside the agency. Right? There are areas where trying to inject economics into part of the consumer protection space results in a little bit of an allergic reaction. But that's a fight worth having, and I think having an economist sort of in-house with you to help not just sort of push economics in, but some of those issues. I came from an antitrust space. I had to figure out some of the consumer protection issues were issues of first instance for me. You had to sit and think a long time before you figured out where you were, and having somebody, an economist on your staff, help you with that, I think is really important. The last piece of advice I would say with respect to commissioner succeeding inside the agency. Goodness, I'm nervous giving that advice because I don't know whether I succeeded or not. I mean, we'll see, I guess. But have an agenda when you come in. Know what you want to work on. It's like drinking from a fire hose the day you come in. The number of consumer protection cases is overwhelming. There's a lot to do. You need to pick the battles you want to fight. And if you're picking them on the fly, you're going to be underwater really quickly. You have your agenda, you come in with it, and you organize your activities around that. Some days, when you're in the dissenting commissioner role, some days you're going to roll the ball uphill and watch it go down, and that's what's going to be what you do for the day. And you have to be okay with that and, you know, get up in the morning and roll it up the hill again, because there are going to be days where you get minor or sometimes major policy wins. But you've got to be patient, and you've got to have a plan. Oh, the first question, that was advice, and then the first question was, what would I do differently, right?
Or what would you have done if you
stayed?
If I had another year. Okay, so.
You did have another year.
Yeah, I had many more. I miss teaching. If I had another year, I will tell you, in terms of agenda items that I wanted, look, none were more important to me than the Section 5 statement. Two come to mind. One is right at the end of my term, I think I started to be a little bit more active in the international space. So Judge Ginsburg and I submitted comments to Japan and also to Canada with respect to amendments to their guidelines at the intersection of IP and antitrust. I think that the United States, the agencies in the U.S., have a serious responsibility when it comes to how they walk and talk with respect to agencies around the world who have widely varying views on the role of patents and the intersection of IP and antitrust. In some cases where I have ended up on the dissenting side, it is, you know, I do not hold the majority view on the intersection of IP and antitrust inside the agency. So there are a lot of 3-2s, there were a lot of 3-2s with Commissioner Ohlhausen and I. And it was difficult in the advocacy context when the U.S. is talking to other agencies to have those views heard through normal processes within the agency. And so I was starting to write comments and stand up on stumps and do a little bit of my own talking with foreign agencies. That's something in my new gig at Mason, where I run the Global Antitrust Institute. We're doing a lot more of that, Judge Ginsburg and I in particular, and that's something that I think is really important and I'm willing to spend a lot of time and energy on. So I would have done more of that. The other thing is, you know, you may have seen that there's the Uber suit in St. Louis. You know, I'm on the record my first couple of years saying we should have brought, not St. Louis in particular, but there are suits we should bring. They're tough suits. You've got state action issues. You've got a couple of things to worry about. There are jurisdictions where I think the FTC, should bring those suits. They're really important issues. I think they're a place where they're sort of perfectly well built, given the FTC's advocacy work in these areas historically. That's a space where the FTC really should be involved. I said that for a long time. I think I probably would have spent some time trying to kick and scream about that a little bit.
So let me ask you, based on your experience as a commissioner and also someone who thinks a lot about antitrust, what do you see as the big looming issues or the major issues that we'll continue to wrestle with in the next few years? And can you elaborate a little bit more on international enforcement trends? You know, is there something that keeps you up at night about what's happening internationally? Any particular views on the amount of convergence and any significant divergence?
The Steelers losing their season opener keeps me up at night. IP trends in the world, rarely. But on occasion. So let me do the first question first. So important areas in the future. I think, and competition law in particular, focusing on mergers for a second, I think you can look at the history of the integration of economics into antitrust in mergers on the anti-competitive side of the ledger, or the evolution of, there's really been a substantial theoretical advancement in the way economists think about unilateral effects from, say, the early 80s to current. And watching how quickly those economic advances have found their way into both the guidelines and to normal practice, antitrust lawyers, you'll see written, never a citation for this proposition, but that economic advances get incorporated into antitrust with something like a 20-year lag. Google that. You'll get 100 sites. Everybody says it. I say it because it's a lag. 20 sounds right. Not so with the economics of unilateral effects. I think it's been a little bit more quickly, and also data advances in econometrics. So people are, the econometrics inside the agency that the staff economists are doing are much more advanced than what we were doing 10 years ago, much less 20 or 30. I think that advanced, there's still fights to fight over, are upward pricing pressure indices a good predictor of effects? Do we believe merger simulation? When do we believe it? All of that. But the analytical toolkit is basically agreed upon, and there's fine-tuning and empirics and some things that have to happen to sharpen it. But if you look at what's happening on the supply side of the antitrust equation, if you look at, for example, entry and efficiencies, go read the most sophisticated law and economics discussion of entry. We're still talking about the economics like it's 1960. In 1960, Stigler wrote a paper about defining barriers to entry, and Joe Bain wrote a paper before that. And we still just say, as antitrust lawyers say in the memos inside the eight, barriers are hard, their barriers are high, or they're yes or no, they're binary. Efficiencies are binary. They either count or they don't count. We think about probabilities with respect to anti-competitive price increases. We think about uncertainty in a more sophisticated way. On the entry side, our guidelines don't look different than what they looked like in 1968 or 82. On the efficiency side, they started in 97. We said, hey, maybe the stuff that reduces price should count. And that's, you know, Oliver Williamson wrote that in 68. That's, you know, a 30-year lag. But it's still the case. We don't have a case litigated in federal court where efficiencies are used to rebut a prima facie case successfully. You know, in a litigated pool of close cases, that's hard to believe that that's the right outcome. And you still get decisions. The St. Luke's decision, I voted for the FTC bringing the case. I supported the case. I think the decision is bad law. The decision says non-price quality efficiencies can't be used to offset price increases. That's economically silly. That doesn't make any sense. And I think it would be hard to get any economist to say that that's a good idea or the way we should think about efficiencies. So I think really the state of the law and the state of importing economic thought into antitrust doctrine, on the supply side, I think we are still not much more advanced than Williamson 68 in efficiencies and not much more advanced than Stigler and Bain on entry. In terms of, it's not that the economists don't think about these things in a more sophisticated fashion, but finding a way to import those ideas into doctrine and agency practice. And that's a problem that's on both ends. It's finding a way for economists to make these things tractable, like they did with unilateral effects, right? It's both in the supply of these ideas and making them tractable and taking the time to retail them to agencies, to lawyers, and to courts. But, you know, it's also on the demand side for the agencies. They've got to want to do that.
Yeah, but do you think it's going to work to take a question from the line?
I don't think we have any questions on the phone. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone and make another call for questions here.
Are there any other questions from the audience here?
We have one question on the phone, so let's try and take this question from the phone. Go ahead, caller.
Hey, Mike Doherty here with LabMD in Atlanta. How are you?
How you doing, Mike?
Good. I'm not going to talk about the case. I just have a general question, maybe about the case in the sense of, as a commissioner, how deep in the weeds do you get in oversight of the actions of the investigators before it comes to you? Because as we've seen in hindsight, in my case, without getting into specifics, I'm really quite concerned about things getting out of hand with a lot of psychological positioning and intimidation and questionable tactics before it's quite frankly way too late. And that, I think, harms the overall agenda that I'm fine with, which is regulatory responsibility and effective regulation.
So I think the question was how
I'm trying to be polite, Josh.
No. And I understand. So let me say the things I need to say in the beginning of this question, which are, I can't talk about pending cases. Nothing that I'm saying is about a pending case. Just like I take your question not to be exactly about a pending case. Can that be a fair set of ground rules?
That's a fair set of ground rules.
Okay. All right. So that said, I'm going to give you, I think, an unsatisfying answer now that we have our ground rules, which is not very involved, to be honest. I mean, what happened, there's a difference on the competition side and the consumer protection side, too, with respect to how often we vote out process to start an investigation and in what type of cases, right? So there are some consumer protection cases where investigations proceed without the commissioners ever voting or knowing. On the competition side, that is more rare because we're voting out process more often, higher fraction of the cases. So if there's an investigation, I am more likely, all things equal, to know of its existence. And if I'm interested in it, ask questions to staff and so forth. On the consumer protection side of the house, I think all things equal, and certainly not in all cases, but all things equal, commissioners are more likely not to know about the existence of investigation, much less how it's being conducted. Right? So oftentimes, if in my experience with investigations generally as a commission, it would be very rare for me to know, once an investigation has been authorized by process or by delegation or otherwise, it would be very rare. In fact, I can't think much of an instance where how the investigation was conducted in terms of the particulars that I hear in your non-specific case-related question are just not very visible to the commissioner's office.
And that actually is a relief, and so that is a good answer. I mean, that's what I suspected, and I hope eventually we can fix that. But thank you very much. And I, as I put out on Twitter when you resigned, I think it's a loss. But I appreciate your time there.
I appreciate that, Mike.
Are there any other questions from the floor? If not, I'll ask one from the phone.
I'm tempted to dial in from my cell phone.
Would you like to ask a question?
Well, sure. I just have a question about, sort of a theoretical question about how much work you've done and what your views are on the intersection between competition policy and antitrust and intellectual property. And I'm also interested in what you think the staff's views are on that intersection, if you have any sense of that.
You know, staff have lots of vehicles to speak for themselves, and I will let them speak for themselves. I think that we have an expert and very highly competent group of lawyers and economists who work on IP and antitrust. I think there are some growing pains as that area grows. It is not, the agency grew up without having patent lawyers in it. The agency grew up having generalist industrial organization economists, not economists that worked on IP. I can tell you in the Bureau of Economics, I will not name them because I like them and I don't want them to get phone calls from reporters. But there are a handful of economists that had worked on IP issues ever before they walked into the Bureau of Economics. Now, I don't mean that as a criticism at all. One of the key points about the consensus on IP and antitrust that existed in the United States at least circa 1995 when the FTC and DOJ put out their joint guidelines with respect to IP was we ought to think about intellectual property the way that we think about real property. Demand curves still slope downward. Firms still profit maximize. We sort of have the same set of tools. And there are factual differences with respect to the treatment of IP that change the economic analysis. You have to, like any economic analysis, think over the institutions and facts around you to get it right. But that was really what the treatment was. The agreement was, we're not going to have special rules for IP. What we do when we do rule of reason analysis or when we do economic analysis of some business conduct, whether it involves real property or IP or what have you, economists have a set of tools. There is a methodology to be applied to figure out these questions. I view the real upshot of that 95 statement between the agencies, and for a long time what we told agencies all around the world, was something that I've called in my writing the symmetry principle and my writing with Judge Ginsburg, which is this idea that we don't change the toolkit for intellectual property problems. We try to take into account all the factual differences, but we don't come up with special rules. We don't start, you know, we're not too hasty. We roll up our sleeves like we would in other cases and try to get the economics right. That requires work. It requires data. If you're doing that right, you break a sweat. This is not something that's sort of figured out, you know, without really thinking about the problem. That consensus, which came after sort of the 1970s era when, you know, if you breathe the word IP, what you were doing violated the antitrust law. The U.S. agencies, there was a lot of work, both academic and within the agencies, to steer the ship in the right direction to get this consensus through the late 90s and I think through most of the 2000s. My own view, sort of at a 30,000-foot level, is that that consensus is unwinding right now as we speak. There are calls for special treatment of IP. I'll give the example of reverse payment settlements in pharmaceuticals. Right, so reverse payments, big issue. Supreme Court says an activist, you do the rule of reason. You do it like you do it in other antitrust cases. I like that. Right, it says this is consistent with the symmetry principle in a way. It says we're going to take this area and we're going to bring it within the normal scope of Section 1 of the Sherman Act, and we're going to figure out whether the competitive harm exceeds efficiencies, and no special rules, everybody go. And it was handed to judges, and that's a little scary when it first happens, but that's the way that the rest of the antitrust law grew in the right direction. But there are calls for, and I think calls that have been heeded somewhat by the competition agencies in this country, for shortcuts, truncated versions of rule of reason analysis. So to use the reverse payment example, it is really difficult to figure out whether a reverse payment settlement, all things equal, is unlawful. I have voted for cases on this theory. This is not a theory that bothers me, that an agreement between a branded pharmaceutical and a generic to delay entry could be anti-competitive and harm consumers. I voted for plenty of cases that were based on that theory. Figuring out, in some cases, whether this agreement is likely to be harmful is tough. It's a tough question. One of the things that some academics have called for, and as there's been some buy-in in courts and the agencies, is that there's a cheap and easy way to do this. We look at the size of the payment. And if the size of the payment is really big, then we infer that the underlying patent is really weak and the agreement must be anti-competitive. Okay? It is easy to do. We always know the size of the payment. We trace the dollars, or if they gave something that's not dollars, we try to value it, and we say something about competitive harm. I've got a paper somewhere. I don't want this whole thing to be me, you know, pitching papers, but that's what I do for a living now. But I've got a paper with a couple economists, Joanna Chai and Bruce Kobayashi, as well as Judge Ginsburg, sort of reworking some of the economics of this and saying, no. It turns out if you do the models correctly, the size of the payment's not that informative. We're just going to have to do the hard work. I think that there's a little, this is sort of one example, I think there's a little bit too much of a demand for these hard problems involving IP and antitrust to look for shortcuts. I think the rule now is called the litigation cost benchmark, right? It's the idea of the size of the payment's better than the litigation costs, bigger than the litigation costs, we can presume the agreement's unlawful. I don't think that there's any economic sense to that proposition at all, and I'm going to try to argue that and so forth. But if you look at other areas, patent holdup, there is federal court cases saying if a patent holder goes into a standard-setting body and he is deceptive about the patent, commits fraud, does something, violates the antitrust laws if it gets his technology included, when it wouldn't have otherwise. That's an antitrust violation. I'm okay with that. The federal courts have spoken about the contours of the traditional antitrust laws in this area. What they don't say is if you're a patent holder and your technology gets chosen and you negotiate a rate, and then you want to change the rate later, or you breach your contract, which sometimes happens in the real world. You want to license to someone else, or you don't want to license to this guy. Breach contract, maybe. Antitrust law violation, absolutely not under the traditional antitrust laws, and no court has ever so held. But the FTC said under the Section 5, before the statement, that's an antitrust violation. Why? Well, unfair method of competition. We don't have to tell you anything else. This is one of the areas, I like to make everything a Section 5 issue, but this is one of the areas where it really is a Section 5 issue. And I think where the statement helps, it says, you've got to show, for something to be a Section 5 violation, you have to show, like we would show in a full-blown rule of reason case, you've got to show that this is anti-competitive. Some of those cases will win. Some of them will fail. I don't have a dog in the fight with respect to the outcomes as much as the methodology.
So the consensus you mentioned that to treat IP like real property is unraveling. Any insights into, like, oh, we're out of time. I'll have to ask you that later. But I know we have a hard stop here in the room, so I'm afraid we're going to have to adjourn for now. I do want to thank the call-in audience and remind them to check our calendar for the next scheduled teleforum call, which is tomorrow at noon, when we'll be talking about the pros and cons of civil juries. I want to thank the people in the room, of course, for coming, and, of course, Covington and Burling, and Deb Garza and Joshua Wright. But until our next teleform call, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.